The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
There are now weapons under development and developed that are designed to target specific people. Right, that's what this is, where you can actually take someone's DNA, take their medical profile, and you can target a biological weapon that will kill that person or take them off the battlefield or make them inoperable. So you can't have a discussion about this without talking about privacy. Commercial data. And people will very rapidly spit into a cup and send it into 23andMe and get really interesting data about their background. And guess what? Their DNA is now owned by a private company and can be sold off with very little intellectual property protection or privacy protection. And we don't have legal and regulatory regimes to deal with that.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
So it's kind of cool. A buddy of mine had his DNA tested, and he always thought he was French, found out that he wasn't French at all. You know, and I'm sure many of you, perhaps you've had your DNA tested, did your genealogy, maybe it was a sibling of yours. That's a stark warning. That was a little audio from a recent Aspen security forum, and thought about where your DNA goes. I mean, who... Do you want that in somebody else's database? How's it going to be used, right? You know, it begins innocently enough. I was thinking about this a little bit earlier. I mean, I have not done it. I had thought about it. I thought it would be kind of cool. But you wonder where that trait of a certain eye color comes from in your family. You might not even really know who your family is for whatever reason, right? So you get one of those kits. You call up, let's say, 23andMe. You spit into the cup. You send the sample back. You wait, and all of a sudden, you get your report, tells you, hey, here you go. Here's who you are. Here's your origins. It tells you your ancestors, where it supposedly comes from. But here's where things, I think, get interesting. You have paid a company to take your DNA, unique to you, right? The only person in the world, and analyze it. And, you know, what you haven't said to the company is, what they can do with that information once they've acquired it, once they're done, once you pay them. They have that data. Data is currency. Data, you know, you take a look at social media and how much data they like to collect. Data has value. They have that data. In fact, they have the data on millions of people, and there are no legal protections for you for what, you know, and what they can do with it. There's none. You have no say. Not only can they analyze it, you know, some more, but they can also sell it. So here, you've paid them to do analysis. And now that they take your most private personal information, they sell it to the highest bidder, right? 23andMe has denied selling any information. I want to make sure I'm clear on that. That's what they say. No, we don't sell this. They denied selling any of the information that they have. But they're not the only company doing this kind of thing, right? I did a quick search before I came on the air here, and I saw a bunch of ads for the top three DNA testing companies. There's a ton of them out there. A lot of people are getting in on this business. But just because they haven't sold the information to 23andMe doesn't mean, you know, that they won't do it in the future. They haven't done it now. But maybe there'll be a practical application for it. Maybe it'll be demanded of them by the government. You ever think about that? What if the government says, we want to collect everybody's DNA? There's more to this, too. One final thought, and Dr. Ann Cavoukian is going to be stopping by. I'd love to hear from you, too, if you want to join Dr. Cavoukian and me. The number's 888-914-9149. Congressman Jason Crow, he's a Democrat from Colorado, former Army Ranger, right? He told a crowd at the Aspen Institute that the DNA information could be used to make a bioweapon. Think about that. To make a bioweapon to specifically target you. Sounds like something out of a James Bond movie, right? Like No Time to Die. But not only that, according to the Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa, who also spoke at this conference at the Aspen Institute, this kind of thing, it can be used, listen to this, to target the food supply. And then there's the whole surveillance issue. If you send your DNA to a private company and they decide, let's say it's worth some currency, we'll sell it to China or to Russia, you know, what power does that give? Can they start tracking you? And so can the U.S. Let's hope it never comes to that. But let's talk about the possibilities here. And nobody better to do that than Dr. Ann Cavoukian, Executive Director of Global Privacy and Security by Design Center. And she's been a tremendous advocate for protecting your privacy. You can learn more about what she does at gpsbydesigncenter.com. Center spelled C-E-N-T-R-E, in case you're looking or wondering. Hey, Doctor, good to have you with me today. Good afternoon.
Many thanks. Always a pleasure.
I thought about you, as always, when it comes to privacy, and I never thought about, you know, getting your DNA. I mean, I'm kind of curious about, hey, knowing your ancestry, but at the same time, I don't want anyone else having that data. You talk about the most intimate data on a person.
That's right.
You know,
what is wrong with people that they would release this kind of information without locking it up first, without having signed declarations from 23andMe or whoever that they will not share it with any third parties without the consent of the individual involved? You have to have these locks on your data, especially DNA sensitive data.
You know it. So what is there right now to prevent a company like 23andMe or Ancestry.com or whatever from selling your data or the data that they currently have? I know a lot of companies say, oh, we don't do that. There's nothing legally that stops them, right, from unleashing that information?
That's right. Legally, unless you have enacted some arrangement with them that says, you, 23andMe, you're not permitted to use this data for any purpose other than disclosing the results to me, that's the agreement. Unless you have something like that that they've agreed to, they can do whatever they want with it. They can sell it to third parties unknown, unauthorized parties. They can do enormous amounts of activities that could cause you great damage in the future. Why would you do this?
Yeah, I know. My guest today, Dr. Ann Cavoukian, and I'll go to the phones, if you want to take a call or two, we'll do that. Or if you want to join me, we'll take a call or two in just a second. 888-914-9149. You know what scares me? Okay, they could sell your data. The thing that really got my antenna up was this. When I heard a congressperson talk about the idea of them making a bioweapon that could specifically target the individuals whose DNA that they have. Now, it seems far-fetched. I'm thinking, really? I mean, honestly, but look, the technology is constantly evolving. What kind of dangers are there out there? Are there other dangers about giving up DNA to a private company? I mean, bioweapons are top of my list, but I'd love to get your take.
Well, of course, bioweapons seem extreme, but we never know what's going to happen in the future. We simply never know. But to see, DNA is the most sensitive personal information about you. It identifies you like no other. And in the wrong hands, it can be used to cause great harm, reveal great amounts of information relating to your health and who you've shared it with and what you're doing. It will reveal so much about why would you want to release this? That's what I don't understand. Why wouldn't you want some walls around it?
Yeah, should governments be coming up with laws to protect that data? I mean, we're in a new frontier here right now. I don't know if any nations are doing that. I don't know. Well, quite often it takes an abuse before a law is enacted, but I would love to see something preventative.
In my jurisdiction in Canada, we have PHIPAA called the Personal Health Information Protection Act, which extends to DNA because that's the most personal health information you're going to get. So there are protections, but I'm not aware of that in the U.S.
Yeah, I'm not either. I mean, I hope one of these Congress people on the Intelligence Committee, you know, may move that thing forward. So a foreign country, I think of China, I think of Russia, and I don't know whether it's possible. I'm not the expert in this area here. I know very little actually about how this all works, but how can they trace somebody based on their DNA or the data that's been given away? I mean, I know they can put you in a database, but and I guess they can track you down if they want to identify you later, but is tracking something we need to worry about?
But think about it. If you're somewhere and you're combing your hair or something, you're going to leave traces of your DNA behind. All they need is a tiny piece of something from your body to have your DNA, and then that can be traced extensively. So to think that this will never happen, I wish that was the case, but I fear that unauthorized third parties will gain access to this very sensitive health information.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. We'll take a few calls. 888-914-9149. Judy's listening in Oceanside, California. Judy, you're on the air with Dr. Ann Cavoukian. Good afternoon.
Hello. I wanted to ask you just said there are so many ways of getting a person's DNA. And if you, for instance, donate blood or donate plasma to a private company, couldn't they, without you knowing it, take your DNA and sell it?
Of course. I mean, that possibility is there. That's why you never give anything like that over to another party without first having them sign a declaration indicating that they'll only use your personal information, in this case in the DNA or medical information, for the purpose intended, and you will identify what the purpose is, and that, in this case, the plasma situation, but that they will only use it for the purpose identified to you, and that they will not be permitted to use it for any other purposes. You have to have some kind of agreement, a declaration like that, before you allow them to take any of your personal information, especially medical data.
Yeah, the scary part is that, you know, even if you have that document, you wouldn't know if they were tinkering with it,
selling it,
or doing what they did. That's kind of the dark side of this. David in Phoenix,
it's
Arizona.
True, but at least you'd have a legal case. At least you have a legal case against them.
No, you're right. David in Phoenix, Arizona says DNA targeting is really is not scientifically plausible. David, thanks for joining us. Good afternoon.
Hey, afternoon, Drew. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Hey, I heard about this last, I don't know when this was, the Security Forum.
Yeah.
And in its current state, I mean, this is Bond movie technology.
Right.
So what 23andMe and the other companies look for are gene groupings that are commonly seen in certain populations. They're not looking for individual, they're not sequencing a person's entire DNA. That is cumbersome and expensive. I mean, normally when we do that, it's a few thousand dollars, and I don't know what 23andMe is. It's probably a few hundred.
Mm-hmm.
And to find unique strands, I mean, the homology between a human and a pumpkin is somewhere around 90%. A human and a chimpanzee is about 98.7%. Individual humans are 99.99%.
Mm-hmm.
And then you need a target in the DNA that actually damages the DNA enough to kill someone, and a vector that can get to the person's DNA. So this strikes me as more scaremongering than scientifically realistic at this point.
Yeah, I'm with you. The thing that grabbed my attention, though, and it sounds like this is your area of expertise too, David, is when you have a high-ranking government official, congressman like Jason Crow, a Democrat from Colorado, former Army Ranger, coming out and warning people about this type of stuff. So I'm just assuming he may know more than we know, but scientifically we're not there yet is what you're saying. Is it possible at some point in the future this could become less expensive and more dangerous?
And the thing is, it's not that I disagree with David. Sorry.
Go ahead, Ann, and then I'll let you follow up, David. Go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say, it's not that I disagree with David. That particular example is extreme, but there are far less extreme cases that could arise in terms of potentially unauthorized access to your DNA. I always say trust but verify. We have to have very clear indications of what's going to happen to your sensitive data, like DNA. How is it processed? Who does it go to? Any third parties gain access? You have to know exactly what happens before you release that information.
Gotcha. And David, I'll give you some final thoughts. Love to hear from you.
I mean, the sequencing costs have dropped dramatically in the past 10 years, but still, I can't imagine a test that costs a few hundred dollars is they're going to do a whole genome sequence to try to – there's easier ways to kill people.
You got it. Hey, David, thank you for joining us and for sharing that.
Oh, yeah. And Drew and David, let's make it clear. The killing people is just the most extreme example that you're providing. What I'm talking about, what I think you're talking about, is other potentially unauthorized uses of your DNA that can be used to track you, used for surveillance purposes, purposes that were never intended and that the individual was never aware of. That's what I'm talking about.
I mean, if there was a nefarious entity out there, some government institution, somebody who wanted my DNA, and I say this all the time because I know you go through Homeland Security, you go through TSA, and I think I don't really want to give up my biometrics, but really, if somebody wants my fingerprint, they can lift it off the door handle of my office or my car, right? If somebody wants my my DNA, you know, they can pick up a strand of hair or get it from the straw that I drank off of, and that DNA technology is becoming better and better. So, you got to draw the balance here, too. So it's like, are you going to worry about this? I don't know. To your point, though, Doctor, I think there should be safeguards about how that personal information can be utilized by private companies. I think that's a real danger there.
Yeah. I would never use 23andMe. I would never even go near it.
Really? Why not?
personal health information is absolutely critical, and DNA especially is the strongest identifier out there relating to you. Do I really want my personal information in the hands of people that I'm not assured of what they're going to do or not do with it? I don't know. It's more of a question mark, Drew. But yeah. Why take that risk?
No, I get it. My guest, Dr. Ann Cavucchi. And again, David, thanks for the knowledgeable and informed comments. Kate in Wilmar, Minnesota, you're on with Dr. Cavucchi, and welcome.
Hi. I'm just wondering if you can access your DNA from a swab for 23andMe. Is it possible to access someone's DNA from a COVID swab?
Doctor.
Well, a COVID swab will have your data on it. That potentially could have, I'm guessing, DNA extracted from it. I haven't examined it, so I'm just speculating here. Yeah. But it's entirely possible.
Well, it's back to David's point, too. I mean, it's be very cost prohibitive unless somebody really wants to get your DNA, Kate.
Yeah.
And they could do that if they want. They can spend the money. They could certainly do that. I remember watching in one of these ID channels. My wife loves those shows. I don't know. women tend to love them for some reason. I can't tell you how many people, women I know that love to watch the ID channel. But there was a woman whose, I think, husband was incarcerated. And she knew that he was innocent. And she did everything she can to try to get the DNA of the perp. She did the police said, oh, he's guilty. The jury found him guilty. She really believed in his innocence. And she pursued other facts, tracked down who the person was that probably really did this. And he ended up being in jail. She had to find a way to get his DNA. So, I mean, if you really want somebody's DNA, you can. But she, out of her own pocket, had to pay to have that DNA sequence. So, we live in an interesting time. You know, technology is accelerating. Costs are coming down. Who knows what other threats loom in the not too distant future there. I know I have you for a few moments today, and the food supply issue, and I'm not a physician, I'm not a scientist. How can having DNA information make food supply vulnerable to manipulation? I don't quite get that aspect of this.
You know, I think people are just suspecting that things like food supply and others will somehow be impacted by DNA. Whose DNA should the food go to? Mm-hmm. People who are, you know, permitted, acceptable, whatever. Right. It's a crazy scenario. But I just urge people, be very careful before you release your DNA to any third parties. And if you go to 23andMe, please don't. But if you have to, get them to sign something very clearly that no unauthorized uses of your DNA are permissible, and they are only permitted to release it back to you. You've got to get something on paper.
Yeah, and again, I'll just put out that qualifier. You know, and 23andMe says they don't sell the information, but there's nothing in writing. So they could say that, and they could always change your course. You've got Ancestry.com. You've got lots of other DNA testing technologies that are out there as well. Again, this is very sci-fi, James Bond-esque, and I don't know if we're there, but I think it's important at least to discuss it, to be aware of the potential direction this can go in. And again, when you've got Aspen security forums and experts talking about what happens with DNA and where it goes, I think it's worth a discussion.
If I can just add, it's not, you know, we're talking about DNA today, but any kind of personal information that can identify you very clearly, facial recognition, things of that nature. There's all kinds of technologies that could potentially identify you very, very clearly and be used for nefarious purposes. So just be careful.
So what's your biggest privacy concern today? Is there something that stands out to you?
Well, I mentioned facial recognition because it is being collected. For example, in England, in the United Kingdom, cameras are everywhere. They collect everybody's facial recognition faces. The error rate is 83% false positives, meaning 83% of the time you are falsely identified as a bad guy that they're looking for. The harm is enormous. So facial recognition concerns me enormously in terms of people picking up your image and doing God knows what with it. That's just one example.
Can they lift, for example, I'm all over the internet, right? I do a radio show, I've got social media.
Yeah.
They can basically, you know, profile, they can create a 3D image of me, right? Right off the web.
You and I are out there, Drew.
Right. So I think about that because, you know, sometimes I use, and I probably shouldn't do this, my cell phone, I have an iPhone. I use
of course.
Facial recognition to unlock my bank account or whatever, you know, so... When the bad guy comes, he just holds the phone in front of me. Can they do that?
If I can add, especially with the iPhone, they have end-to-end encryption. They have a very, very strong protection. And the kind of facial image that your iPhone collects is called one-to-one, meaning your face to the image you gave to Apple for the iPhone, and it's called one-to-one. That's not a problem. I use that all the time. Okay. What I'm concerned with is called one-to-many, like the UK example that I gave, where your facial image is compared to hundreds of thousands of others. One-to-many. That's the problem.
Got it. Well said. Let me go to Fort Myers, Florida next for you. Aaron is wanting to join the conversation. Aaron, good afternoon. Thanks for dialing in.
Hey. I agree with... having some agreement that they won't use your data. But I know in the past, my wife's a connoisseur of reality TV, and she tells me that they've actually found serial killers by pulling the genetic information from all these other sites that people pay, they have actually found a serial killer.
Yeah. Wasn't that the Golden State Killer?
That's my only comment.
Was it the Golden State Killer? There was a guy that was evasive or elusive, Aaron, for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they finally tracked him via DNA. And I'm sure a lot of law enforcement departments are now doing this. They're
of
finding
course.
A suspect. They're getting the brother. There might be some DNA at the scene. They don't know who it is. But I could see, there would be a federal or national database at some point in the future where... they can go ahead and do that. Maybe at birth, they take your blood, your DNA. Who knows? I don't know. This is sci-fi. I'm going down a rabbit hole here. But apparently, Aaron's wife loves the ID channels, those crime shows, too. My producer, or not my producer, the executive vice president of programming at the network, he's my chief programming officer. He'd say the same thing to his wife. He'd say to her, who's killing who today? Because she watches it, too. What's up with women, doctor? Loving this so much.
Oh, that's hilarious.
All right. Peggy in San Pedro, California. Good afternoon.
Hello. Can you hear
Peggy.
Me okay?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah. I'd like to say that I don't know if anybody knows this, but just recently I was watching something on YouTube, and I heard that the father of JonBenet Ramsey wants to get the DNA tested with that C.C. Moore or somebody like her. Yeah. Who can do the detective work with the genealogy, and the police won't do it. Well, I can't understand that. But the problem is, he says, they just had their mindset that they were the guilty party, and they won't check anything out anymore.
That's interesting, Peggy. It's a fascinating story of the death of JonBenet Ramsey. And I know the father was in the crosshairs of that investigation for a while. They never found that killer. And I don't know why you wouldn't use DNA if you could do it. I mean, that sounds like a no-brainer to me. Doctor, I know you got to run it in a moment or two, but I want to get people connected to you. And they want to be more vigilant on their privacy. What's the best way to connect with you or learn more about this or just get up to speed on what they need to know?
Oh, please feel free to refer them to my website. I know you've mentioned the website, and I've got my email in there. They can send me an email. I always respond. I always want to help people.
And so let me ask you a personal question. I don't know your backstory. We've been talking for years. How did you get so passionate about defense of privacy? Why did this become, I don't know, your bailiwick, your passion?
Okay, I'm going to tell you a very quick story. So I'm Armenian. That's my background.
Mm-hmm.
And as I tell people, privacy forms the foundation of our freedom. It's absolutely critical.
Yeah.
In 1915, there was an Armenian genocide. My grandparents were in the prison. They were going to be killed the next day. And my grandmother told me stories about how in the prison, if you spoke too loud in ways that the soldiers didn't like about things, they would kill you right on the spot. I know that sounds extreme.
Yeah.
It was just by good fortune that my grandparents escaped. And they conveyed to me the importance of privacy and freedom again and again and again. Nothing to me is more important than freedom, and privacy forms the foundation of our freedom.
Well, I am so grateful that you are doing this. As I often say, God brings good out of every situation. I know you're helping a lot of people, and I'm grateful for it. Hey, I'll let you run.
Thank you
for being here with me today. I look forward to the next time
my
we
pleasure.
Talk. It's always good.
Thank you so much. A pleasure, always.
You got it. That's Dr. Ann Kavoukian, the Executive Director of Global Privacy and Security by Design Center. And She actually, believe it or not, she's best known for her creation of this privacy by design. She unanimously adopted as an international framework for privacy and data protection back in 2010. You can follow her. Her Twitter handle's at Ann Cavoukian, at Ann and Cavoukian, C-A-V-O-U-K-I-N. And, of course, her website, gpsbydesigncenter.org. I find this fascinating. Look, technology continues to accelerate. I think privacy is becoming more and more difficult to hold on to. But let's be vigilant. That's all we can really do. I'm going to take a break, but when we come back, let's pick it up. I want to fill you in on some other news that is unfolding. And if I have time today, I don't know if you have allergies. I've never had an allergy a day in my life, right? Something's changing. Something is changing. The past 2 years now, I've been battling this. I'll fill you in on what's in the dust, all right? We'll get into that maybe a little bit later, but when I return also, I want to tell you what's happening with a group of evangelicals and really an attack on defending marriage. It's another interesting story. We'll get into it when I return.
This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
In that case that nationalized same-sex marriage, supposedly the adult said, well, this has nothing to do with kids, right? This is just about with whom you share love and connection. But what we saw is that when you make husbands and wives optional in marriage law, very quickly, mothers and fathers become optional in parenthood law. And that was made obvious in the case of Pavan 2 years after Obergefell, where two women could put their name on a child's birth certificate, both as parents to a child, legally erasing the child's father. So this is 100% an issue of children's rights. Marriage is an issue of social justice for children. And when we fail to defend marriage as it is properly understood, we fail to defend children.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That's just so well said. Marriage is not about the two adults that are involved. It's also about the children. It's about their rights. And that's such a great clip from the Family Research Council saying that when we fail to defend marriage, we fail to defend children. And so often they are overlooked. I remember somebody once talking to me about divorce, and they said, you know, when a couple divorces, they lay down their cross and the children pick it up. And it really put it into perspective for me. You know, really, we often think about the husband, the wife, and what marriage is about. But look, if you have children and you've got a family, everybody is involved. That's for sure. I, you know, something came across our show's radar here, and something I've been talking about. I don't want to spend too much time. This stuff can be a little heavy, you know. But I think it's really important for you and I just to be aware of it. We can't be silent. We can't ignore it. We can't hope it goes away. You know, we need to pray and we need to be active. You know, we need to be politically active in this. We need to educate. The so-called Respect for Marriage Act, right? That's been passed by the House of Representatives. And a number of Republicans, you might remember, joined with the Democrats to get that done. And the bill was written as a response to Justice Clarence Thomas, his concurring opinion in the Dobbs-Jackson case that overturned Roe v. Wade and the Casey decision. So, and we talked about this a little bit in the past where, you know, he made this comment, he made this statement that this whole idea of something called substantive due process is really just a bogus idea, right? That the idea is what several other decisions, you know, have been based on since, what, 1960s? And you can go back, and this is what has so many people scared, right? And this is why you're seeing the reaction we're seeing today. If you go back, the contraception ruling, that was Griswold, you know, versus Connecticut. Yeah, of course, you had the abortion ruling. You had Roe v. Wade and Dole v. Bolton. The ruling on sodomy, you know, was Lawrence v. Texas. And then the ruling that defined marriage in 2015 was Obergefell. These are all huge, huge cases. They've really had a profound impact on our culture, on our society, on some of the very fundamental principles that people have held forever that have changed, like how we view marriage. Is it between a man and a woman, or is it not? Is it something more than that? Where do you draw the line? Is it between two men, two women? Is it between, is it polygamous? You know, I mean, there's so many different things, so many different directions this can go in. But the concept is that, you know, all of those things are based on this idea that rights can somehow, right, they can be divined from the Constitution based only on the process used before a person is deprived of life, liberty, or property. In other words, according to Justice Thomas, the court has basically been making it up for years. That's kind of his view on it. And a lot of people are not happy with him at all. So after Justice Thomas said that, what did we see, right? Well, supporters were so frightened, you know, the supporters of the, you know, sexual revolution got so scared, they realized, uh-oh, hold on a second. There are no laws that protect these so-called rights. So what did they do? They said, we better draft some bills. We got to do it right away. So they came up with what sounds like a great act, right? The Respect for Marriage Act. You know, that it sounds great, but it gives a pretty wide-ranging liberty to how states can define marriage. In fact, it says that, you know, any definition of marriage made by a state is one that the federal government will recognize. So whatever you come up with, we're going to recognize it. The federal government's with you, right? No problem. However you define it. But is anybody thinking anymore? What happened to rationality? What happened to critical thought, right? Just on the surface of that, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to grasp this idea. That presents a major problem, right? Problems, you know, on so many different levels are only now just beginning to be seen. And I've invited today Eric Niffen to join me. He's, you know, worked on the HHS mandate, and before that he was at Beckett Law, and it's great to have him here with some big cases he's been involved with. He worked on the mandate as well as the Hosanna Tabor case and other religious liberty cases, and it's been a great friend of this show, a convert to the faith, and delighted to have him back again today. Eric, thanks for your time. Good afternoon.
Good to talk to you, Drew.
So do me a favor, or do everyone who's with us today a favor, and explain what Justice Thomas was saying. I tried to, in simple terms, kind of lay it out, but can you briefly explain substantive due process, it may be layman's terms, so everyone can understand that.
Sure. So I'll try to do this simply. The due process clause, sort of there's a constitutional right to due process. And so what does that mean? And people can say, well, that can mean the procedural due process, that the government can't take away your life, liberty, or property without jumping through certain without proceeding through all of the necessary steps laid out in law. So the government can't just show up and say, you don't got your property no more. So that's procedural due process. And so the end result might not be fair, but at least the government ticked all the boxes. And then the other side of due process that is developed through Supreme Court precedent, what's called substantive due process. And that means that what the Constitution guarantees, according to this theory, is not just certain procedures, but also certain basic fairness. Right. And it's through that concept of basic fairness, that fundamental rights have been right. Fundamental rights have been added to our Constitution through that idea that there's a substantive component to due process.
So where are the other Supremes on this issue? I you know, Thomas, I thought, was pretty clear, makes a lot of sense to me. How do they view that?
Well, I think I go back to Justice Scalia. So Justice Scalia called himself a faint-hearted originalist. Huh. And what he meant by that is like, look, I believe originalism is correct, but at the same time, I think there's certain battles that we aren't going to win, and we don't have to sort of relitigate everything, and at a certain point, we just have to move on. And so he saw that as sort of more of a practical approach to it, and just sort of said, there's certain things I disagree with, but I'm just not going to fight on them.
Right.
And Justice Thomas has taken a different tact, and he's done this for decades. And he's been very, very consistent and very, very clear, always in his dissents, saying, look, this is the way I see the Constitution. This is the way I see the law. This is what I think it means. And so there is nothing surprising at all in Justice Thomas's concurrence in the Dobbs case. It's what he's been saying for decades is, right. Look, I know I'm kind of a crank here. I'm not the only one who's going to say this, but this is right. What I think the Constitution means. And so, you know, to those of us who follow these things on the right and the left, it's just really a shrug. and no one else joined that position.
Yeah, that makes sense. The Respect Marriage Act, that's a byproduct of that statement. In some respects, people are scrambling. It's supposed to codify Obergefell. That was the decision that redefined marriage. Does it just do that, or does it do more than that? Does it throw open the doors to a slippery slope?
Well, I think it's one of these bills that on its face, it's pretty benign. Like, you read the words, and if you didn't understand the sort of the political and legal context, it doesn't say same-sex marriage right in there. You know, so it's written pretty neutrally. But I still think there's important things there that we need to pay attention to and think. I do think it would move the ball in important ways. One thing is Obergefell, remember, said that although the Constitution was said to contain a right to same-sex marriage, the Supreme Court said those who adhere to religious doctrines may continue to advocate with the utmost sincere conviction that same-sex marriage should not be condoned.
Right.
And so that was part of Obergefell, was this sort of promise that said, look, we're announcing this new right, but we're sensitive to the religious liberty concerns, and we are going to continue to hold that those people are acting in good faith, they're not bad people, and they will have the liberty to hold on to their convictions. And the important, where that relates to this bill, Drew, is this little phrase in here that says that no person acting under color of state law may deny full faith and credit to marriages recognized in other states. So it's not just governments, but also anyone acting under color of state law. Mm-hmm. And that's a tricky phrase. And there are certainly some people who will say, oh, no, no, that only means government officials and maybe government contractors. And there are legal arguments for that. But there are also legal arguments for saying that anyone who takes a government contract, anyone who takes government money, is carrying out a public policy or a public benefit on the government's behalf, on the state government, the federal government's behalf. And it's not hard for those of us who are following these things with religious liberty concerns to imagine someone saying, well, you know, because the government wants to feed kids lunches, and because you as a Catholic school are participating in that program, you are now a state actor. And so therefore, you as a Catholic school are now bound to adhere to this. And so you're not, and the government would say, we're not forcing Catholic schools. We're forcing Catholic schools who participate in the school lunch program to do this. And similarly, we're not forcing this on Catholic hospitals. We're forcing this on Catholic hospitals that take Medicaid money. And that's all Catholic hospitals. And so I think that's one of the real concerns here, is that this phrase is going to be interpreted broadly in order to undermine religious institutions.
So could there be problems with tax-exempt statuses if the bill gets passed?
Oh, that could be. I know that's sort of a possibility that's been out there since the Solicitor General during the Obergefell case sort of shrugged and says that maybe that'll be an issue down the line. Yeah. It would have been really easy for him to say, no, of course not, but he didn't. But I don't think that would be a direct result of this bill. I think this bill is just another way to try to marginalize those who hold on to biblical natural law understanding of marriage and to sort of go against this principle, which I mentioned from Obergefell, which says, hey, there's a lot of people who believe in traditional marriage, and they do so for good reasons, and they're honorable people, and there's definitely room for them in our society. So this is another nudge to try to push those of us to the sidelines.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. Yeah, I was thinking about just, you know, what's the possibility if, let's say, a state defines marriage, they redefine it, and they say that, you know, marriage in this state is more than two people. You know, the churches that don't recognize polygamy, could they be sued for refusing to do that ceremony if that state says, hey, this is a law and the federal government recognizes it?
Not for actual celebrating the marriage. That's where I think churches are going to continue to remain safe. I think at the outside, Drew, what will happen is that priests would stop signing marriage licenses.
Right.
It would be more like it is in Europe, where you have your church ceremony, and then you go down to the courthouse and you sign your paperwork there.
Gotcha.
So the civil and the religious parts of it are separated, which, you know, wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. So that's not really what I'm worried about.
Right.
But I do think it is easy to imagine, you know, one state passes a polygamy law and then somebody gets married there, and then this gets weaponized, and that person moves to a conservative state and enrolls in a religious school and presses the issue, brings a lawsuit, and it is not at all hard to imagine that being done. I mean, we've seen what happened to Jack Phillip here in Colorado, and you know, all of that has been ginned up in order to attack him, in order to undermine his business. And similar stuff would happen here. You know, as soon as one state gets aggressive in passing a new understanding of marriage, that'll be this bill, if made law, would be used in order to really press that on religious institutions in other states.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's gonna ensue. Let's pray and let's continue to make everyone aware. Hey, Eric, thank you. Thanks for your time and for all you've done to defend liberty and, you know, bring truth to the culture. I'm grateful for your time. If people want to follow you or get connected to you, what's the best way to do that?
Oh, you can look me up at Lewis Roca is my law firm. And, happy to talk to anyone who's got religious liberty concerns.
Appreciate it. Again, Lewis Roca in Colorado Springs. All right, Eric Neffen practices law there. And I'm just delighted to be able to share the mic with him. I've got to take a short pause. Stay with me. I'll be back right after this.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
You know, our Lord has often preached about being good stewards of God's gift. And a legal will, W-I-L-L, guarantees that the important people in your life and everything that you've worked hard for will be taken care of according to your wishes. And, of course, our Catholic faith. So I don't know if you have a will. I'm surprised by how many people don't. 3 out of 4 people don't. You can make a will. Relevant partners up every year. I think this is the second year they're doing it with a group called Free Will. If you go to relevantradio.com/freewill, you can get more details. It's relevantradio.com/freewill. It's absolutely free. Thought I'd put that on your radar today. I'll be talking about that. I know a lot of my colleagues have been mentioning it throughout the day. We'll be talking more tomorrow about that with you too. So will's an important thing to have, believe me. You know, I was saying to somebody recently, who's, I think parents are dying, I said, you got to really make sure things are clear, because, you know, I've seen more families destroyed. You might know this, you know, more relationships ruptured over money, over something as fleeting as money and possession. And it's a rough time when you lose somebody. It's raw, you know, and yeah, your emotions are not where maybe as stable as they normally are. So having a document like a will to kind of stabilize things, make things clear so that your kids aren't at each other's throats or your loved ones aren't at each other's throats, probably a good idea. Just something to do. I know people tend to put that off quite often. Hey, this Halloween, maybe even Christmas, you might be out of luck getting your favorite candy. I don't know if you heard this story. I used to live in the land of William Penn, Pennsylvania, right? The Keystone State. I saw a report that Hershey, they've famous for their chocolate. Of course, I don't know if you've ever been to Hershey Park, kind of a cool place. They came out, I think it was the other day, warning that because of global supply chain, you know, the ingredients for chocolate, for candy, including coca and oil, it's been adversely affected by the pandemic and, of course, the war in Ukraine. And they're warning already. You're months away from Halloween, right? You're months away from even Christmas, holidays, Thanksgiving. There could be a shortage. I know people like to make their chocolate chip cookies or do their baking and do all that type of stuff around that time of year. So it may not be Halloween. Might go all the way through the Christmas season. So I'm giving you a little heads up. I should have probably ran out before I gave you this heads up, this little tip, and got my own chocolate, right? Hershey's says that not only are the raw ingredients becoming harder to come by, but the number of suppliers are also declining. So if you like doing that, you might want to run out and get some things ahead of time. I've also been following one other story I want to share with you, and that's the situation in Lake Mead. And I'm going to ask you to pray for our country, especially the godsend rain to our West Coast, right? We are experiencing a mega drought. And I've been following the shrinking water levels there at Lake Mead. And you know, it's fascinating. You think you can get away with murder. Lake Mead keeps revealing new secrets. Last week, another body was found. Yeah, one was found, you might remember, I think it was in a barrel, something along those lines. This time, the body was found in the mud. It was around what's called Swim Beach. And that's the third body that has turned up since the water started receding because of this intense drought in that area of our country. So one of those bodies is to believe have been connected to a mob killing. And the FBI right now, I guess that was a cold case, are now investigating it along with the local authorities. But the lower water levels, they turned up, and I've shared this with you in the past, a Higgins landing craft is a boat that used to be used during the Navy during World War II for landing troops on the shore, and a touring company was, you know, using it on the Colorado River. So it'll be, I hope we get rain. I hate to see the water levels continue to drop. And one final story for you here. This is an epidemic in our country. Pornography is an epidemic. The state legislature, you might remember, you know, there was some bad news a little bit earlier from Kansas, but there is good news coming out of Georgia. And you may not follow this, but in Georgia, the state legislature passed what's called the heartbeat law back in 2019, and an appeals court allowed it to go forward after the Dobbs decision. Now, residents are expecting a child on or after July 20th through the end of the year can claim that child as a dependent, right? You can claim that child as a dependent for personal exemption for $3,000 per unborn child. That's good news. Yeah, it's not a bad deduction. I want to applaud that. These are the types of things we need to see more of. We need to talk about them. We need to share them on our social media. Let people know that there's a value in life. Look, there's even a financial benefit here. But yeah, on another note, pornographers are getting into some trouble. I don't know if you heard this story. Of course, legal efforts to curb them has really failed. I mean, there's a thirst, a hunger for pornography in this country, and it's really quite sad because I really believe it's demonic. There's a lawsuit against a company called MindGeek, a company that owns Pornhub, and I think it's one of the biggest purveyors of pornography online. It's also against this credit card company, Visa. Billionaire hedge fund manager Bill Ackman is taking a very vocal stand right now against Visa, saying that the credit card giant, they have the power to pressure Pornhub to remove child pornography from its site. And I would say bravo to you, Mr. Ackman. Good job. Or I should say Ackman is actually, I think, his name. He wants then to pressure Pornhub to take this child porn off its site. Take a listen to this interview he did from CNBC.
A U.S. District Court judge denying Visa's request to be removed from a lawsuit that also targets Pornhub and its owner, a company called MindGeek. It stems from a court case brought by a woman who was forced to watch sexually explicit videos of herself be distributed online when she was underage. The judge in the case says, quote, Visa is being kept in this case because it is alleged to have continued to recognize as a merchant an immense, well-known, and highly visible business that it knew used its websites to host and monetize child porn.
The business persists because it's funded, or the payments are funded through the Visa and MasterCard network. And what shocked me was, you know, the network is, you know, it's one of the greatest businesses in the world, owning the pipes that convey commerce and taking a little royalty on every payment that goes through. But a key part of their business is, you know, Visa's job, if you think about it, is maintaining brand integrity. You know, this is one of the most important brands in the world. When people put a Visa card or a MasterCard or American Express card out of their wallet, what drives them is the power and the quality of the brand. If you think about the most important risks to that brand, reputational risk, regulatory risk. But remarkably, the company, despite being entirely aware that there's child pornography on these sites, and it's littered with child pornography, they continue to provide payment services until the Kristof article, and then they shut down the sites overnight, which would have bankrupted them. And then within a matter of weeks, they reauthorized the merchants and they started accepting payments again. And the crime continues.
It's all about money. That's what it's all about. The background here, they were sued by a woman named Serene Flites, she was only 13 years of age. And her boyfriend pressured her into making a porn video. And the boyfriend uploaded it on Pornhub. And of course, people can't get enough of it. There's a genre for everybody. She immediately regretted it, contacted Pornhub, who made promises to take it down. But guess what? They didn't, right? So Visa tried to get out of the suit, but a federal judge in California ruled against them because the judge said that Visa knew that they were financing child porn. So I'll leave you with this. Let's just pray. Let's hope that the jury finds both MindGeek and Visa guilty as the sin that they are promoting. And let's pray for those who are victims of this revenge porn and just porn in general. I feel so bad for so many people who get swept up in that world. There was a great interview that we did, Maggie. I don't remember if you remember that. Gosh, I should replay that, of a guy who made 1,000 pornos. And Joshua Bloom's his name. Thank you. And he had a radical conversion. Radical conversion. Maybe I'll rerun that for you in the not-too-distant future. God's grace can touch anyone. Let's pray, all right? We'll pray against the culture of death, this culture of sin that we're in. Let's pray for each other. I'll be praying for you. I'm out of time for the day. I wish we had more time to talk. Kel Clark's coming up, but I'll be back again tomorrow. We get to hang out for 3 more hours then, all right? Until then, remember God loves you, and so do I. Have a good afternoon.